Hey, and welcome back to Extra Features Editor. Today we have a fantastic guest who we finally hooked up. I'm very excited. Eric Christopher Myers is here. He brought his film Butterfly Kisses, and that's about it. I'm all going to give you guys. Hey, Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. This is very fun, very exciting.
Well, you said you've done hundreds and hundreds of these, so I'm going to ask you bizarre questions then, right?
I didn't say hundreds and hundreds. I said thousands and thousands.
Well, you're a superstar down there in Maryland. I mean, everybody knows you.
Not at all. These conversations were all with my therapist, so they don't really count on the same level as what we're doing here.
Oh, that's a positive then. So are you trying to confuse your viewers in the beginning? Because you give me a black and white film, then you switch to color.
Absolutely. I figured that way I keep people on their toes, and it's best if they are not sure exactly what they're watching.
So I guess my first question is, did you shoot the whole film in color or the whole film in black and white, or you had the plan to edit in different colors?
It was planned to edit in different colors on different camera types, shooting in different formats.
So you're going to leave me hanging here? What kind of cameras did we use? Why did we do that?
You want to know all the specifics?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
You said you've heard my interviews, so I'm going to give it to you hardcore.
Bring it on, man. We were using Canon stuff. We were shooting on a Canon high-def camera for the documentary stuff, and then for the documentary inside of the documentary, we were shooting mini-DV.
So, okay. Now, I want to know, like, you're an indie filmmaker. I'm sure you didn't have a big budget on your film. At least I didn't see one. If you did, fantastic. You hit it on me.
Well, you know how it is with indie films. I mean, the whole nature is trying to fish two pennies out of your sofa and, you know, rub them together and make it look like you've got 25 cents. So there was a lot of, you know, sort of, there's a lot of creative management that goes into making a film like this. And I was very fortunate to have an incredibly strong team of people working in all the various departments who were able to rise to that challenge. And I think the movie looks like it costs significantly more than it did.
Do you want to reveal to me the budget or no?
I probably shouldn't.
That's fair. You told your therapist, though.
It's a fair question. It's a tricky thing to navigate. I hate talking about the business side of these things. I'm the artsy fartsy guy, you know.
Let's ask you some artsy fartsy questions then.
Go for it.
How did you find your locations?
They were all based here in Maryland. I'm a Maryland native, and I was really, really fascinated throughout my entire life with ghost stories, urban legends, and cryptozoology and conspiracy theories, coming at it from the skeptical side. But you know, the whole question of belief systems and why people buy into, you know, crazy sorts of you know, fantastical concepts that, you know, fulfill some sort of need for themselves to answer questions that we don't have answers to. That stuff is really fascinating to me. And so the central location in the movie is a train tunnel. It's a real train tunnel in a place called Ellicott City. And Ellicott City is a place that is very famously reputed to be haunted in this area. So like all of the shops, all of the local businesses and hotels, they've all got ghost stories. There are walking tours in this place where people can go and visit and maybe see something or hear something. And this train tunnel, which is carved into the side of a cliff and is accessible only by crossing a trestle that spans a river far below, is this incredibly creepy place, even in the broad daylight. And it's a place where teenagers go and hang out at all, you know, hours of the night, and they hoot and they holler and they run around and they scare themselves, and they believe that they see or hear creepy things that are happening in the tunnel. So when I wrote Butterfly Kisses, my idea was to take a place that was already creepy, but even more importantly, already had a reputation for being haunted, but did not have a particular legend or boogeyman ascribed to it. So what I did was I created this supernatural being called Peeping Tom, or the Blank Man, or any one of many names, you know, that have been told on the playground generation after generation for the past 100 years. And I you know, gave this place a real boogeyman with a real set of rules. From there, you know, we shot there and we shot in a number of other locations. Local businesses opened their doors to us. We got to shoot at the local radio station, DC 101. It was very exciting how many people were willing to open their doors for us.
So did you just go up to them and say, hey, I need a radio station. Can I use this? There was no issues there?
My last film, Roulette, came out in 2013. And just after the release of the film, or the week of, I did a radio interview at DC 101 with the DJ there, Mike Jones, who's just an awesome dude. And he said to me after the interview, Eric, when you do your next movie, first of all, bring it back here. So we can do another interview and, you know, we can promote it some more and talk about it. But can you give me a role in your next film? I'll just be like a waiter walking by in the background or something. So I remembered that, you know, and I try to file away, you know, those sorts of conversations and those sorts of people that I meet and, you know, any opportunity to work with them on a next project. And so in this case, I called him up and said, hey, dude, you remember you wanted a cameo? Well, if you're game, I've got a role for you. And we filmed there with him.
Okay, so where did you find your actors? That's another one of my favorite questions.
To preserve the really super meta aspect of the movie, where we had a lot of real people who were playing themselves, what I did was I sort of looked at the two movies that are happening concurrently. You know, the documentary that's happening in 2015 and then the documentary that's inside the movie that supposedly took place in 2004. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to populate the 2004 found footage, with finger quotes, with as many actors that I could find who were very experienced, primarily in theater, more so than film, and would be able to, you know, stay on book with the screenplay that was provided, but also had the skills to be able to improvise and go off book as I threw them curveballs. So we, you know, we put out a lot of notices, particularly in the theater community, various forums and Facebook pages and things like that. And we kept the project a dead secret. We didn't say who the director was. We didn't say what the film was about. And we brought in as many unknowns more so in the film world, or, you know, had minor credits. And, you know, we auditioned them, and that's who we put in the found footage. For the documentary around it that supposedly takes place in 2015, I needed to fill that movie with real people playing themselves. And so about 99% of the people that you see in the color footage, they are local or, you know, nationally known best-selling authors or film critics or radio hosts or work on reality TV as editors. We filled it with as many real people as we could. So it's a really interesting sort of game to play there to make those two sides balance out.
Hold on. So can I get into the film and ask some specific questions then?
Go for it.
Okay. So you're telling me the documentary filmmaker in the color version is a real person, like a real documentary filmmaker?
Well, like I said, 99% of those people were real. Okay. He and his wife and his mother-in-law are the exceptions.
Okay.
They were actors. And they also were people that, again, had done film work before, but you know, it was regional sort of work.
Okay.
Just like the people that we found in the, you know, for the other documentary.
Well, that's what I want to discuss next.
So my whole goal was to make sure that what few actors I had in the color footage from 2015 would be people who would be able to help the non-actors emote, you know, to be able to give a performance. Because they're all very charismatic people, but, you know, when you start giving non-actors dialogue and telling them, I need you to do this and stand there and blah, 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 you know, you're playing with fire. It could potentially look very stiff and not even a little bit real when the documentary needed to look real. It needed to look as real as possible. And so I filled it with these three roles, these three actors who were very strong. And the documentary filmmaker you're talking about in particular, Gavin York, was a guy I've known for over 20 years. And I put him in the lead role here and just had him, you know, poke the bear with all of the real people as much as humanly possible and, you know, piss them off as much as humanly possible so that they sort of let their guard down and just went with the moment.
I got to give Gavin York full credit. Like, he worked for me a lot. And I think if he doesn't work, your film doesn't work.
I 100% agree. That was the most important role that I had to cast. And not just because he carries the movie and he is, you know, I mean, when you're doing something that is a documentary, whether it's a real documentary or a mockumentary or whatever you want to call it, the subject has to be dynamic. He has to be, he or she has to be somebody that the audience is going to be invested in and that they want to go on this journey with. And so obviously you need somebody strong there. But again, all of his scenes, with the exception of the, you know, the couple of scenes with his wife, they were all real people. And most of them had never stood in front of a camera before. And so it was really, really important that this guy be charismatic, whether that's good charisma or bad charisma, but could then be infectious enough that he would be able to draw performances out of these people. So, yeah, he carried so much weight on his shoulders in this film, and I think he did an amazing job.
I do have a couple of other questions just on filming locations and things.
Sure.
You start the film off in the black and white. It seems to be very, I'll guess, summer maybe. It could be fall. It's kind of hard for me to tell.
The sound footage is winter.
Okay, it is winter? Okay, it's hard to tell. It's, I found the black and white footage. I made a note, very grainy at times.
Yes.
So I'm sure that was pre-planned by you, which is fine. I just had problems deciding when it was filmed.
Yeah, that was all shot at the beginning of 2015. And we were blessed or cursed with snow every day we shot, with the exception of, I think, one day. It snowed every single time that we showed up. So if you notice, if you go back and you look at it, there is a progression where at the beginning, the very first scene with the kids outside of the tunnel making their school documentary,
yes,
it's starting to flurry.
Yes,
and
I agree.
And after that, the footage that they continue shooting that's used as a lot of B-roll has heavy snowfall coming down. And that was, you know, just after. And the scenes that follow, you're seeing snow on the ground that then begins to gradually melt and melt and melt and melt as the winter is wearing on. So it's very cool in that sense. When we did the documentary portion, the 2015 stuff, we did that about 3 or 4 months later, and we specifically waited until it was, you know, high summer so that, number one, we needed the time to be able to go in, take the found footage stuff from 2004, edit it together, and have Gavin York's movie, the movie that he is in the movie, showing around and trying to get opinions on. We needed that to actually be cut because we needed the people who were going to be in the 2015 footage to be reacting to something that they had actually seen. So we had to put all of that together. We took about 3 months. We basically ended one movie and jump-started another one. And then we started shooting in the summer for the 2015 footage.
Uh-huh, okay.
And it had the great effect whenever we returned to locations like the tunnel or like when we went to the author's house that was in the found footage with where the ground is covered in snow. Suddenly you're seeing this, you know, this dynamic explosion of leaves and grass, and it just looks so dramatically different coupled with the color that it, you know, the goal was to plant that subconscious seed in the audience's mind and say, yeah, this could be 10 years later. Yeah, this is a different time period altogether because these locations look so different. And it's just a question of waiting a couple of months.
Oh, great. Okay. You'd see you're rocking this interview. You're doing amazing. Now we're going to ask you some more fun questions.
Go for it.
You brought up the author's home. He's a real author then, from what I'm understanding you.
Yes. Yes. His series, Weird U.S., which then is broken into regions. There's Weird Maryland, Weird Pennsylvania, et cetera. all about, you know, local ghost stories and you know, kind of creepy urban legends and whatnot. He's very, very well known, particularly on the Eastern Seaboard.
Okay, I'm going to have to ask the question I want to know. Did Gavin really push in that match that you stopped filming, or is that acting?
It was a little of both.
Because I thought he looked pissed.
He looked pissed. And one of the great things was that Gavin would show up to set, and he never broke character. And he was Gavin York from the moment that he walked into a room. And he was a guy who was high energy, but kind of a smarmy douchebag at the same time.
Oh, 100%. I would not want to hang out with this guy.
Yeah. He's one of those guys that he's great for one beer. And then, you know, when you get to the second beer, you're like, oh God, this guy won't shut up. That was the character. And because we were trying to, again, generate performances out of non-actors, it became important that they didn't know the real guy. You know, they didn't need to have a rapport with him. They needed to have this guy come in and just be, you know, offensive in every sense of the word and just push all the buttons and rub you completely the wrong way. So that scene was scripted. But what we did, you know, sort of off to the side was I was, you know, telling the actor, you know, hey, do this, say that. Or, you know, when he responds with his line of dialogue from the script, throw something in there that might piss him off, or, you know, mm-hmm. So I was egging him on kind of off to the side. And yeah, the author, Matt Lake, was supposed to, you know, end the interview. That was in the script.
Okay.
But he got pretty pissed off because Gavin was saying things that weren't in the script, that were mostly involving attacking his book.
Yeah.
And the film that you've seen and the film that's going to be released this fall, it's 91 minutes, but the original cut of the movie was 3 hours.
Oh my God.
So it was like killing my babies every minute that I had to, you know, cut out. There was some wonderful, wonderful stuff in there. And that scene that you're referring to went on like twice as long. And Gavin was just insulting the book in every way humanly possible. And Matt's a very, very charming and very lovable kind of guy, but it was really starting to rub him the wrong way. So he reacted for real.
I was wondering that, 'cause I'm like, that's really good.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And I'm proud to say that since doing Butterfly Kisses, he has now thrown himself headlong into every film project that he can possibly act in and does tons of theater. So he caught the bug.
There you go. Okay, so let's keep going on this trend. Now, Gavin goes to see a Paranormal Activity group, I wrote.
Yes.
Now, you're saying they're real, too.
They're real as well.
Where do you find these clowns?
All of these people were people that I either knew or had to fish for. And all the real people in the film didn't take much convincing. They didn't take much convincing to come on and play themselves, particularly when they heard that I was going to be in it playing myself. That, you know, was a selling point. It was like, okay, well, he's not just going to make you look like an asshole because he's going to kind of make himself look like an asshole too. But, and they were all people that I knew or was, you know, developing a rapport with, and they realized that I wasn't going to do anything to hurt them. Or their reputation. The ghost group, however, was a completely different story. We reached out to just about every paranormal group that we could find in the area, and they were all saying no. They were just slamming their doors in our faces, and they were afraid of being put on camera and made to look stupid. And the argument that I had was, hey, look, no, I'm not trying to make you look stupid. You know, that's not the objective here. Just because I don't personally believe in ghosts, but I'm fascinated by people who do believe in ghosts.
So am I.
That's not how we want to portray you. We almost want you to look like, you know, if your fear is that you're going to be made to look like you're gullible sorts of people because you believe in a fringe subject, that's not something that should be a concern. We want to make it look like Gavin thinks you'll be an easy mark and then he's going to be able to use your built-in Facebook audience or whatever and have you endorse his footage because you're gullible people and you believe in this stuff. And the reality is that you take one look at this and you're shrewd enough to go, this is fake. And so that you actually are, you know, discerning and intelligent people who, you know, are not gullible enough to just buy into anything anybody puts in front of them. So I had a lot of trouble conveying that to a lot of these folks. And when I finally reached the group that's in the film, they're called Inspired Ghost Tracking. They were willing to play ball. And so I did have to show up at their meeting. And I think I stood up in front of them before we filmed for probably an hour to 90 minutes explaining to them exactly what this weird meta film was going to be and putting them at ease that they weren't going to be made, you know, to look like chumps. And I thought they were great.
They didn't look like chumps at all. I'm just like, what are these guys doing? I just, I don't know. Not my thing, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, no, I get you. But they were really cool, and they were fun. I mean, the group was probably 25% larger than that when I first started talking. And a quarter of them were still, you know, kind of nervous about what this movie was going to be and didn't know if they wanted to be on camera for it. The rest of them all, you know, got into it. They enjoyed the fact that they were going to be able to tear this guy a new one. That's more footage that ended up on the cutting room floor that I wish I could have kept.
Oh, see, I would like to have seen a bit more of that. I think the film needs about another 5 minutes of that.
Oh, there was probably another 10 or 15 minutes of that. It was wonderful. It was wonderful stuff. And at this point, I think only one or two of the folks that were in that group have made it out to a festival to see the film, and they really liked it. The rest, I'm supposed to be taking it back next week to their VFW where we filmed and showing it on their projector and letting them have a sneak preview of it. So hopefully they feel I did right by them.
Okay. You have a scene when he's – what's in his beer? So it must have been Gavin's beer. I made a note. Is it a real beer?
This is the most awesome question because I'm literally asked this question at every single Q&A. Somebody, and it's funny, you know, when I go and I watch the movie being played, I don't watch the movie. I watch the people watching the movie.
Of course you do.
And that moment, there are people who just get big WTFs floating and flashing over their heads, or they're turning and looking at one another and go, what the hell is he eating? The truth is that is a restaurant, a brew house called Red Brick Station. I've been going there for 20 years. I have all of my production meetings there. It's my favorite place in the world. And the owner let me film there, which I'm very, very grateful for. They have a seasonal beer that is a blueberry ale, and it has blueberries in it. They put actual blueberries in it, and it floats at the top. And the beer that I love to get is like a black and tan, except it's a black and blue. So it's half blueberry ale, half stout. And so, you know, you've got the stout head and you've got the blueberries floating in it. And when we sat down to do the scene, the actor who plays Gavin looked at me and he says, so what would Gavin be drinking? And I said, he'd be drinking what I'm drinking. Because, you know, that's the kind of person he is. He'd find out what the guy that he could possibly, you know, that he's schmoozing up to and trying to get exposure from with the release of this movie, he'd order what I was having. And so he went, done. And we both got a black and blue. And in that particular take, he reaches in and he pulls out a blueberry and he eats it. And I specifically used that take, even though I had takes where he didn't eat the blueberry, just because I was like, oh, this is kind of just a cool little, you know, realistic character moment. And I had no idea that it would become a question that everybody asked.
Sorry. So it's kind of fun. It's just one of those things. You're like, what? What is that?
Yeah, I know. I like having people ask. They're like, you know, what was that, a bug? Did he pull a bug out of there? Did he have what was that?
Oh, you don't know. You gotta ask. Okay. I want to go into a couple questions exactly about the movie, if that's okay.
Go for it.
I'm not gonna ruin anything, because this happens very early. Who leaves film containers by a furnace?
Film containers by a what?
Furnace.
Well, I mean, that's one of the great unanswered questions of the movie. You know, we establish first thing in the film that that Gavin's in-laws bought this house.
Yes.
And they moved in, and, you know, a couple months later, dad-in-law goes downstairs and he finds this box of mini DV cassettes. And nobody noticed it before, not when the house had an inspection, not during various walkthroughs. Nobody saw it. So how did it get there? And it's one of those things that, you know, I sort of throw in there and then don't really explain because, you know, we go into that whole segment later in the film when we're like, so who made this footage? Did the kids make it? Did one of the kids play a trick on the other kid? Did Gavin shoot this? Did he do this and now he's trying to pull off a hoax? If he did, he would have had the opportunity to sneak this box into, you know, his in-law's house and hide it under there so that he had a, you know, he had an alibi. You know, it's and the curious fact that none of the footage actually takes place in that house. So how did it get there? That's intentionally left unanswered.
Okay. I do have a question. If you don't want to answer, it's near the end of the film.
Sure.
And this is a very minor quibble I have. So you have a scene with Gavin and his wife.
Yes.
And I'm going to try to be as vague as I can here. And they're discussing finances.
Correct.
I thought that was a little strange. I thought that kind of pulled me out a bit.
Which aspect of it?
Okay. You want me to get exactly into it?
Go for it.
Okay. I don't want to ruin it for anybody. When Gavin says, what do you mean we're out of money? Do you know what I mean?
Was it weird to you that he said that when the camera was on, or was it weird that he just said that in general?
Just in general. I really thought that was strange. I'm like, okay, so this guy, like, it just pulled me out, I guess, a little bit out of the film at that point.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I guess I'm asking what you were going for there, because I didn't get it, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
My take on it, and the reason that I had that in there, aside from, you know, it explaining a plot point, was the fact that he wasn't working anymore.
Okay.
And he had become so obsessed with, you know, with this footage that he had discovered. And the fact that he was convinced that this was, you know, $1 million in the bank already.
That's what I thought. You know, okay.
There's the whole subtext or outright text throughout the film about, you know, the obsessive belief of the artist. And we find this in, you know, any discipline, whether it's filmmaking or graphic design or dance or whatever. You know, a guy in a garage band is convinced that the song he has written is going to be on the radio and it's going to make him millions of dollars and make him famous. The filmmaker shooting his independent film, this is going to end up, you know, it's going to get picked up and then it's going to play in a movie theater and then I'm going to be at the Oscars. You know, that belief is what drives the artist to create, but it is so often the same manic sort of energy that isolates them from friends and family. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, while the artist can see in specific detail what they're trying to create and the value in the merit, it still comes down to their belief in the invisible. And the invisible isn't something that the people around them can fully understand or relate to or believe in the same way. And so he's looking at this footage and he's convinced he's found the Blair Witch Project for real. And it's going to make millions and millions and millions of dollars. And his wife is like, you just found some, you know, unfinished horror movie some kids made and it was in a box. I support you. You're my husband. You believe in this. This is important to you. Okay, go forth and do your thing. But it becomes such an obsession to him that he's not doing the wedding jobs anymore. And he's spending all of his time on my set, in my documentary, doing his investigation. And his wife is having to go to her mother and borrow money. And, you know, they're running out of it. And Gavin is just so blissfully ignorant of the state of financial affairs, but also the state of his marriage and how it's falling apart. He's completely out of touch and he can't be reached. So that was why I put that in there, that he doesn't even know what's in the bank account because he's not paying attention to anybody. His own kid doesn't want to talk to him when he tries to talk to him.
That's an amazing answer. That's way I okay. Perfect.
Awesome.
You've said you've screened this film to numerous people, I guess, now, from what I'm hearing from festivals and such like.
Yes, we've done a couple of private screenings, a couple of public screenings, and a bunch of festivals.
So how do you find the festival circuit?
At this point, I think we have got 9 awards. So it's doing pretty well. The festival response has been really strong. I've been sort of trying to go 50% horror festivals, because you're sort of going right to the audience, and then 50% general festivals, so that you can maybe, you know, sort of reach out to people who wouldn't normally see this kind of film. And because it is such a weird film, I mean, it's, you know, when it comes out, you know, it's gonna be filed under the horror section. You're going to find it on Netflix under horror. But I think that it has qualities of other genres that don't just put it into one solo category. So it's been cool, you know, to have people at these festivals who are like, I wouldn't normally watch a horror movie, but hey, it's playing, so I'm going to watch this. And they're like, wow, this is really cool. So, yeah, I mean, the feedback's been really strong, and it's been an incredible opportunity to meet a lot of other people, audiences, but also other filmmakers, and, you know, make friends for life.
So being an independent filmmaker, you have to do a lot of work on your own, as I know and yes. You know. Is your plan to dump it on a streaming service? Are you looking at a DVD release?
We have a distributor. I have signed the paperwork. In fact, right before I got on the line with you, I was putting all of the files together on a hard drive that I have to deliver. I'm not allowed to say who the distributor is yet.
I understand.
But it is an awesome distributor. I'm very, very excited. And it's going to be out sometime this fall, I would think probably around Halloween. There will be DVD and Blu-ray, as well as streaming services, video on demand, the whole nine yard. I'm hoping for Redbox and Netflix and Hulu and Vimeo and all of that stuff. So I'm hoping it does well.
So I guess I'm going to have to – have you discussed that with them yet, or you haven't got that far?
Oh, yeah. We've discussed all of it. I'm very confident in all of the things that I just said.
Okay, great. I know you can't say anything. I get that, so –
like I said, this is what producers are for. They talk about all this business.
Exactly. But I'm going to ask the questions anyway, because I have to.
I am here to discuss why there were blueberries floating in the beer.
Exactly. Are you ready for fun questions?
Yep.
And you're prepared for these? You've already heard them once. I could change them, but I won't. You probably don't remember them.
Bring it on.
Favorite film?
Oh, God. Can I give you, like, my favorite 20?
You can have 3.
Are we limiting this to genre?
Don't care.
Across the board?
Anything you want.
Oh, my God. Probably.
Your 6-year-old's going to hear this in 10 years, so you better make sure he's watched these.
All right. I'm going to say probably The Lord of the Rings, which I consider those one movie.
I agree, too. At the same time. I have no issues with that.
Okay. The Exorcist.
The best horror movie ever.
And, oh, God, this is where it gets tricky. This is where it gets real tricky, because I could say An American Werewolf in London. I could say The Empire Strikes Back. I could say Boogie Nights. I could say John Waters' Female Trouble. Pick any one of those.
Hold on. Female Trouble.
Female Trouble.
Let's start there.
Go for it.
I've never heard of it. I know who John Waters is. I've seen some of his films. I've never seen – why Female Trouble? What?
Female Trouble was shot here in Baltimore, where he films all of his movies. And it was his second film after Pink Flamingos.
Okay.
Came out in 1974, was distributed by a then unknown New Light Cinema, who were just distributors at that point prior to A Nightmare on Elm Street. And the film is kind of like Goodfellas in the sense that it is a decades spanning crime narrative. In the sleaziest, trashiest, one notch above pornography sort of way, as all the earliest John Waters stuff was, just nasty and disgusting to be nasty and disgusting. And you know, when I was a kid and I wanted to grow up and be a filmmaker, you know, of course I wanted to direct the next Star Wars, and I wanted to direct you know, The Lord of the Rings before it had been made. And you know, I had these lofty sorts of ambitions. And a friend of the family gave me a VHS copy of this movie, Female Trouble. And he said, this was shot right here, right basically in your backyard for you know, nickels and dimes. And it will blow your mind. And so he gave this to me when I was 14, and I watched it. And it completely changed the way that I thought about film, specifically independent film, and that anything could be shot anywhere as long as there was a, you know, a really cool idea behind it and a way of getting the audience's attention. And so years later, when I shot my first film, Roulette, my first feature, I had the opportunity to include in a small role a very, very well-known character actor named George Stover, who is a staple of all the John Waters films, and many other beside. And it was – Female Trouble was his very first film that he ever did, and Roulette was my very first film that I ever did. So having him in there was like a, it was like a rabbit's foot for me. So that movie has a very important place in my heart. I suggest you watch it.
I'm going to. I made a note. It's on my notes. I do go back and watch films people recommend I haven't seen.
Awesome. You need to watch it, and then you need to tell me what you thought of it.
Yeah, it'll be on Twitter. Don't worry. I'll put it on. Second question. Maybe you've just answered it. It's Friday night. There are people over, and they want to watch a film. Your buddy. Could be somebody you just met. Maybe me. What do you make me watch?
Tough question again. Probably, you know, it all depends on who the audience is, what kind of movies they gravitate toward. But I'd probably say on a Friday night, let's watch A Nightmare on Elm Street. Let's watch the original Elm Street.
I have no complaints. That would make me happy every time.
That's just a crowd pleaser.
Okay. I'm looking at your DVD shelf. What film besides Female Trouble, since I've already pulled that off the shelf, said, why do you have this? What other film would stand out to me?
Standing out. Let's see. Gosh, I feel like I have to go up and look at my shelf now. But, God, that would stand out.
Shouldn't be there.
I have an entire collection of Z-grade films because I love trash masterpieces. Possibly Lord of the G-Strings, the female chip of the string. That might jump out at you.
That would definitely jump out at me. And I'd probably pull Nightmare on Elm Street and go, I want to watch this.
Well, it's you know, it's a curious movie because it's soft porn. And I'm a huge Tolkien fanatic. So I'm like, obviously I have to have this because I just have to have this. And it's one of those things you start watching it and you're like, let's just fast forward through the girls making out and get to the story.
Yeah.
It's kind of the inverse of what it's supposed to be. So it's pretty amazing in that sense. So yeah, you know what? I'm going to go with Female Ship of the String.
I guess since I've never heard of it, is it like a trauma film?
It's like I said, it's a softcore film. It's not porn. It's like right. You know, what you'd see on Cinemax. But it's a really so unfunny that it's hilarious parody of The Lord of the Rings, starring a lot of young ladies wearing very little clothing and reenacting the Lord of the Rings storyline between, you know, deciding, oh, we've been walking all day, let's make out, and so they make out in the woods.
I love it.
It's wonderful. It's good for the whole family.
Well, I want to thank you for – oh, before you go, we can't find your film yet until October, so I can't even tell people where to buy it.
No, they can't buy it yet, but they can buy it. It's the perfect stocking stuffer.
There you go.
Because my kid needs to go to college. So that's why it's the perfect stocking stuffer.
Okay, well, thank you for your time. You've been awesome.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Have a great night.
Do the same, sir.
Bye-bye. Don't hang up. You still there?
I am still here.